a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes, to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes. My heart.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org, and we're also podcast at iTunes. If you go to radio, public radio, and click on KUCI FM, you can listen immediately. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. As always, Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today is all about noir. And my guests are Naomi Hirahara, Gary Phillips, and Susan Strait. All have stories in the anthology Los Angeles Noir, edited by Denise Hamilton and published by Akashic Books. Naomi, born and raised in Southern California, is the Edgar Award-winning author of the Ma Sarai mystery series, which features a Japanese-American gardener and atomic bomb survivor. Her short stories are featured in Los Angeles Noir, A Hell of a Woman, and The Darker Mask, while her middle grade book, 1001 Cranes, will be released in August 2008 by Delacorte. She's currently at work on the fourth Ma Sarai mystery for St. Martin's Thomas Dunn. And we'll be talking about number 19, her story that's in Los Angeles Noir. Gary Phillips is the editor of the recent anthology Politics Noir from Verso. Gary writes a weekly online political thriller, Citizen Kang, on the Nation's magazine website, and he's editor of the upcoming Orange County Noir. His story in Los Angeles Noir is Roger Crumbler Considered His Shave. And Susan Strait is the author of six novels. Her latest, A Million Nightingales, set during slavery, is the first of a trilogy about the characters who appear in The Golden Gopher, her story in Los Angeles Noir that recently won an Edgar, the biggest prize you can win for mystery writing. Let's get them on. Hi, you three. Y'all there?
Yes.
Yep, nice to see you.
And Susan?
Yes, that's me.
What about Naomi?
We haven't heard Naomi.
We lost Naomi.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to have to find Naomi. While I find Naomi, perhaps the two of you could talk about noir and sort of, you know, what it does. As I understand it, it's a subgenre of the mystery genre, which and runs contrary to mysteries, where things don't always work out, and the bad guys sometimes get away, and the good guys may turn bad. Am I on the right track?
Well, I think that I'll just jump in, and then Susan can jump in. Yeah, I think noir is about essentially it's about characters heading toward their own doom, and they usually can't see. Although we, as the reader or the viewer, since the noir really comes from the movies, can see or at least get a sense of this foreboding, but because they themselves are so enwrapped in their story and in their quest, and usually their quest is a bent and twisted one, they don't see the end that's coming for them. So that's really kind of a shorthand. I mean, noir is used a lot of different ways now, I suppose. I mean, it's grafted onto a lot of different kinds of stories. But I think at the heart, that's kind of what noir is about. It is about desperate characters trying to eke out a kind of desperate, twisted goal that for them they think will. It's not redemption. I mean, it's not, you know, in classic literature, you know, your characters sort of seek redemption, but in noir, the characters actually are just seeking material gain.
Yeah, that's a great way to end, because that's the way I look at noir. I think of noir as the classic, they're seeking redemption, and usually it has to do with money, love, or land. Someone always is trying to take away somebody's land, or trying to get somebody else's money, or trying to get the love they feel they deserve.
Yeah.
Especially in your story, Gary. Someone's trying to get the love he feels he deserves. And in my story, somebody has killed somebody else because he feels that person doesn't deserve the love that he actually deserves. I think people will get rid of anybody else to get one of those three things. Three things that make up America.
And Naomi, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right.
I'm here.
Excellent.
We're talking about noir and what it does and how perhaps it differs from the mystery genre.
Well, you know, the lines of classification kind of bleed, I think, from one thing to another. And even within noir, because I'm like a huge, like, Chester Himes fan. And I think of all the noir writers, I feel like, you know, I'm walking in his footsteps. And, like, someone like Chester Himes, he doesn't have, like, the loner, you know, the typical loner sleuth who's, you know, wandering around L.A. trying to, you know, dealing with all this darkness. I mean, he almost has kind of this absurdist twist on noir. So... I think with mystery, and I do write some traditional mystery too, and you know, it's all about kind of solving the puzzle. And I think with noir, it's more the characters and their obsessions, and it usually leads to no good, you know, and there isn't that clear kind of definition at the end of the mystery or end of the noir story.
Hmm. Interesting. So you know, in your story, number 19, let's talk about each of your stories for a minute. In your story, I found the setting original, extremely original, and I could relate to Anne's compassion for the masseuse.
Yeah.
Only she goes a little too far, I think. But will you talk about what inspired it, and then what pulled the story to its conclusion for you? And did you know where it was going? I mean, do you outline? Did you figure the whole thing out?
Well, number 19 takes place in a Koreatown spa, and what prompted it was I actually went to a Koreatown spa, not for the intention of doing any research, but to celebrate a birthday with a friend. And it turned out to be kind of a traumatic experience for me. And not that I'm, you know, a Puritan about nudity. Everybody, you know, gets naked all in one room. But you know, I, like you mentioned, Barbara, in terms of having empathy, you know, Anne has this empathy for this masseuse, and I think in the same way I'm kind of plagued with that same kind of sensibility, and I started talking to the masseuse, and they were all dressed like in their underwear, you know, because you get wet, and it wasn't like, you know, this Palm Springs spa experience, and I'm really fascinated with, you know, I write a series with Gardner, you know, who's the sleuth, and my own father is a gardener, and I'm fascinated about, like, ethnic trade and why certain ethnic groups get involved in certain kinds of trade, and I just started talking to this woman, and one of my first questions was, well, when did you come to this country? And then there was this big pause, and I knew that was a question maybe I shouldn't have asked.
Mm.
So that night, the night after, I had this huge nightmare, and this masseuse appeared in my nightmare. And I said, I have to use this in some way, and I wasn't quite sure how. And later on, when Denise asked me to write something, I thought, yeah, it's all about outsiders. My protagonist is an outsider, and the masseuse is an outsider, and how their two words collide. And I didn't really have an outline. I just knew I had this character with a certain obsession, so I was just going to follow her through. And I knew, unfortunately, it had to lead to some kind of violence. And instead of a gun, I looked at a golf club.
Yes, you did. All right. And, okay, Gary and Roger, wow. I don't know how far into this story I started sort of yelling in my mind, Roger, will you just wake up? Don't you see what's going to happen here? And the ending, and at the same time, the ending was satisfyingly vague. At the end, I wasn't really sure if Roger had just had a breakdown or if the police were actually after him or if they had come to tell him something about the wife. Or I really kind of liked the ending that way. And I'd love to know what you had in mind. But moreover, if you would talk about the story and how it began and then, again, what drove it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the ending, Barbara. It's, so certainly I think one of the tenets of noir is creeping paranoia. you know, your characters are always, even though they don't get wise in time, because, well, otherwise, if they got too wise, well, we wouldn't have a story now, would we? but they do start to have certain inklings, and so I think, you know, one of those things then becomes, I wonder what's really going on, and, you know, is this really this, and is this really that? So, for me, in the story is called Roger Crumbler Considered His Shave, and the story begins with a middle-aged man. He's on his 50th birthday as he, you know, sort of does his morning ritual. He's taking a shave in the mirror, and he's a middle-class guy with a middle-class house and middle-class wife and daughter in college. But he has taken that step out of line. It's actually kind of a different kind of story for me because I generally write about crime at the street level. I guess that's the point. And then for this, it was kind of more of a white collar crime as the instigator, as the part of the story. But then of course it has all these other things that happen to him. Like Naomi said, that I usually outline my novels. I don't really outline the short stories, though I'll always make some notes. And once I have the idea for what the story is, I really kind of just think about it for a while. I'll do other things, literally for days. Like I'll write other stuff, or I'm cutting the lawn, or whatever it is I'm doing around the house, or whatever else it is that demands my attention, and then. Almost in a burst, I'll try to write the story out, just because I'm like in his head or in the characters' heads, and I want to get it down on paper, or not on paper, but I guess the monitor, and then eventually just print it out and kind of go back through it. So for me, the story is particularly short stories, because I think short stories are so great because they have to be punchy. They have to just move and get to hopefully a satisfying conclusion. And so I just sort of live with the story for a while. And then just try to get the thing out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Susan, You're known for your literary novels, and so I'm so curious about your departure into noir and the writing of The Golden Gopher, and you know, how the story developed and concluded. Would you talk about that?
Well, I did it because Denise Hamilton told me to, and I like her, and she's nice, but it took about a year, but it was really, just like for Naomi and Gary, it's really a matter of that noir, I think, is kind of the sense of the inevitable, and it also does, it takes a lot more work than you think to write a noir short story as opposed to a novel where you have time to do a lot of things, and the strangest part was that we picked neighborhoods for this anthology, and that's what I like about all the noir series that Akashic does, is that each story is set in a different neighborhood, and you really get this representative feel for the whole city. And of course, I'm from Riverside, so she's like, I want you to write for LA Noir, and I said, you know, I can't put Riverside in LA. And she said, yeah, you can. And I thought, oh, okay. So then I looked at the neighborhoods that were already taken, and they were a lot of the classic neighborhoods, you know, Hollywood, Echo Park, Los Feliz, and I had seen this bar downtown called the Golden Gopher. I'd been seeing it for years every time I would go downtown, and it was just this amazingly bad-looking place, and I did have a story that I'd been working on years ago called the Golden Gopher, and when I told Denise that, she gives out this big gasp, literally one of these really theatrical gasps, and her father-in-law used to own the Mexican restaurant that was right next to the Golden Gopher, and she had all these horrible memories, and so did her husband, of what a bad place it was and how they used to cart bodies out of there. But my story wasn't really about that at all. It was about something that had taken place in the past in the town I always write about, the fictional Rio Seco. And mine is strange, too, because I worked, when I was an undergraduate at USC, for 4 years I worked in the oceanography department as a work-study student, and we had a mail run. Every day I would go and take the mail all over the campus. And I got to know all the staff and the secretaries at USC, and they were all black women. Mm. Almost 90% of the women who worked in the offices were black women. We were all friends for those 4 years, and there was one woman who used to ride the tram with me, and she was the most beautiful woman in the world. She really was. She was probably about 25, and she was so beautiful that men used to look for her every day on that tram when we rode. And I never could get her out of my mind because she had that kind of beauty where I saw men looking at her. And the only thing they really wanted, I think, was to have her. Do you know what I mean? To possess her or to own her. Not necessarily to love her or take care of her. And I never forgot that either. And somehow that mixed with the Golden Gopher. That beautiful woman is killed. And the main character in the Golden Gopher is not a beautiful woman. She's a writer. Because, you know, that's what happens to the rest of us. And she is going to tell one of the men that loved this beautiful woman, Glorette, that she wants to tell him that Glorette is dead, and he instead confesses that he took away the great love of Glorette's life because he wanted to have Glorette instead. And it's really strange about writing because all those things that you've thought about in those little scenes, those little snippets of something that you saw 20 years ago, they all work their way sometimes into a story or a novel. And I like that. I think that's probably the greatest pleasure of my life, because the rest of my life is so bad, usually. It's all these kids and all this work and all the other things, but at night when you're writing, all of those little scenes that you can kind of remember them viscerally, they worked their way into this story, which ends up being about the murder that the character didn't even know had taken place.
So did you have the ending when you started? Did you know that it was going to end up where she finds the guy in the bar? And
I knew she was going to find the guy, and I knew she was going to tell him. But this is the 10th story. I've written 10 stories now all around this dead woman, the most beautiful woman in Rio Seco. And they're all from the point of view of people. In fact, one of them was in the Cocaine Chronicles. Mm. That was the story where the woman is actually killed. Mm. And all these 10 stories are about how people looked at this beautiful woman. And so Fantine, the character who's in this story, she was always best friends with her but kind of jealous of her. And she felt bad that this woman had descended into prostitution after the love of her life left her. So I didn't have any idea that Grady, this guy, had killed the love of her life. The Love of Gloretz Life. I had no idea until I was still worried about the Golden Gopher, getting all the details right, so I had to go there, and that was pretty scary. I tried to talk a lot of people into coming with me, and nobody would do it. I had to do it by myself, and I'm old and really unremarkable looking, so it was not a good place for me. Nobody looked at me at all.
I wouldn't say that, but...
yeah, it was really funny how old I felt.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with three authors today, Naomi Hirahara, Gary Phillips, and Susan Strait, and we're talking about a lot of things, but they're stories that are included in Los Angeles Noir, published by Akashic Books. And one thing I love about these anthologies, because I've looked at quite a few at this point, is, as you mentioned, Susan, they're broken down into neighborhoods or cities, and each story kind of focuses in on a specific city, and I love that, and it brings up the topic of place and how place figures into these stories and into noir itself. Would you three address that? And anyone can go first.
Well, for me, the downtown area, it seemed like such a strange place to write about as far as LA goes, because at that time, we were writing these stories about 4 years ago, and downtown wasn't really experiencing the renaissance that it is now. And the whole homeless population was just immense. Every time I would go downtown, especially at night, I was astonished by how many homeless people were on the street. And I wanted to capture that sense of place. But I think place is such a great aspect of noir that people don't talk about very often. Of course, I'm reading my Ross McDonald and Raymond Chandler this summer because that's what I like to read. My classes ended yesterday, so I was reading Raymond Chandler last night. The sense of place, the descriptions of the streets and the palm trees, but also just the way people move around in their fictional cities or their real cities, that's a big deal, I think, for noir. I think landscape is a whole other character.
Hmm. What about you, Gary?
Yeah, I certainly agree that, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. I mean, I've been to other cities, both here and overseas, and of course, it's always an adventure as you try to at least learn a little bit about these places that you go as a kind of a tourist, or you're there on some kind of business meeting, or, well, I don't know if writers are conduct business, but whatever we do as writers, when we're sometimes in these other places. But for me, I was born and raised in South Central L.A., which now, of course, is totally much different. I mean, it was a black working class area when I grew up. In fact, the street I grew up on Flower Street, my dad had a union job. Mr. Caldwell next door worked for the gas company. Mrs. Lewis next to Mr. Caldwell was a teacher for the LA Unified. Mr. Guy, who lived at the end of the block, worked for the railroad, because they were all part of that sort of black migration from the South and the Southwest. My dad came from Texas, who came in the 30s and 40s. When they went east and they went west in search of sort of something better than what they had. And so when I grew up, that area reflected that. And now, of course, it's totally the flip. It's mostly Latino. And so for me, it's like I'm always rediscovering a city that's constantly changing around me. And even in the story, Roger Crumbler, it's set in what is called Mid-City, and I actually live in Mid-City. Our kids grew up in Mid-City, Mid-City, L.A., which is literally geographically in the middle of the city. And so to the extent that that has played a part in terms of just my development now as a writer, I try to reflect that in the story. But, funny enough, I was thinking, as we were talking about this, I was thinking yesterday, I start out in my house, and I'm doing something, I was writing something that I had to get done. And I go see my aunt, who still lives, who's like 91, and still lives by herself in her little house in the Crenshaw District. She lives near Dorsey High. So I go from there, see my aunt. I go see my aunt, and I go to Norwalk because I do this program with incarcerated youth. I go from Norwalk to Placentia in Orange County to do a speaking gig. Interesting enough, with Denise Hamilton, our editor, at this library in Placentia. And then from Placentia, I'm listening to The Game because I'm, of course, praying the Lakers win. but you know, the game coming all the way back to L.A., and that's, you know, that's just like, that's not like a typical day, but it's like, you know, it's like, that's just kind of like the Southland. I mean, it's like you go to these different areas, and you go to these different parts of what's considered this broader, huger community, and it's all interlaced with these freeways upon freeways, and then you always think, you know, I've been thinking more and more about, well, of course, you know, just the gas you're burning up, but then also just how do you have to plan your trips now, because you can never quite figure out what's rush hour anymore. You know, there's a standard rush hours, but then it just seems to be that rush hour seems to float around a lot now, and there's always traffic, or there's always some pileup, or, you know, a truck is jackknifed or something, so you always have to allow for that. Now you allow yourself, you know, an hour ahead because, you know, you're going into unfamiliar territory, so you're not quite clear what the road conditions were going to be, or God forbid there's a detour and you got to get off, and now I'm like, oh man, I don't have no, you know, I don't have a navigation. This is, I don't even have a map in the car. What am I going to do now? You know, just driving around. But it's like all part of like just the Southland experience where we exist, you know, freeway to freeway, car to car, but somehow or another, there's all these other communities beneath the freeways and interlaced by the freeways, and you kind of try to reflect that in some of the work.
Interesting. This is great.
I think that for me, place is really important in all of what I write about, and I like to write about L.A., but I kind of enjoy writing about the communities that people don't hear about, like Gardena or Montebello, or, you know, it's not in necessary. I guess film noir had a lot of, like, Los Feliz area and Silver Lake, but there's other communities or Hollywood that are out there, or maybe there's another side to Hollywood that people really haven't read about. And I like to look at the surprising things about a place. And for instance, Koreatown, which at one point actually a lot of Japanese lived there, and I went to Japanese school every Saturday in Koreatown. But what I find fascinating is now there's a whole bunch of golf driving ranges, like in all the city, right? So I knew, you know, I just love that clash of the urban, you know, against whether it's like a garden or a golf course or a driving range, you know, just the clash, because I think we see that, you know, all over our communities as they change. And I don't think, you know, I could have described Koreatown in more depth, but for me, in my short story, I just wanted things to be really compact, more about this. So in a way, I wanted the place to kind of seep through the characters. So even though there's not a lot of physical description in how the characters relate to the place, I was hoping that the readers could have a sense of, you know, the geography.
We're going to take a real short break, so stay with us. We'll be back with Naomi Hirahara, Gary Phillips, and Susan Strait, who will read from their stories and talk more about noir. So don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Thank you. little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. We also are podcasts on iTunes, and we have about 300 shows up now archived on our podcast site, which you can access at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. This show will go up in the next week or so, so you can listen to it again and pick up what you may have missed as you were swerving to get that exit on the freeway. I'm with Naomi Hirahara, Gary Phillips, and Susan Strait. Y'all still there?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I'd love to hear each of you read from your stories in Los Angeles noir. Would you begin, Susan?
Sure.
Yeah, just a couple minutes. Let's give our listeners a taste of the stories and show them why they must check out this book.
Okay. So this character, Fantine, is living in Los Angeles, but she's from a place like Riverside. And she's a travel writer, and she's gone downtown to look for this guy named Grady Jackson. In front of the Golden Gopher, a bucket slammed down on the sidewalk, and someone began to wash off the tile. A homeless guy, green army coat, black sneakers glistening with fallen foam from his brush and rag, and black jeans shining with wear and dirt. His hair was thin and nappy, and a brown spot showed on the side of his head, like the entrance to an anthill. Grady? Grady. He'd had ringworm in Mississippi when he was a kid, and he'd always combed his natural over that place. It was him. His hand moved back and forth over the tile, washing off fingerprints and smudges. He was missing most of his right ring finger. I watched him for 10 minutes. He washed the tile, wiped down the door. I didn't move. His eyes moved over me, but didn't pause. He went inside, and he never came back out. Other people stepped in now that the Golden Gopher door was open. Two actors from the O.C., 3 young women wearing heels and carrying briefcases, a guy in a suit. I crossed the street and went inside. This was not a dive anymore. It looked like Liberace had decorated, with chandeliers and black pillars and even little lamps with gopher shades in gold. I squinted inside. The jukebox played Al Green. I didn't see Grady Jackson. But his sister Gloria was there. She worked in an alcove to the side, like a little liquor store. She was arranging 2 bottles of Grey Goose. Her nails were red, but her lips were thin and brown. She looked old now. Hattie, I said. Gloria Jones, she said to me. She knew me. She said, you know what? When I first came here to L.A., you had Pam Grier and Coffee and all them. My mama named me Hattie after the Gone with the Wind character. Who wants to be a maid? I changed my name a long time ago, after you was here that first time with my fool-ass brother Grady. Was that him? Outside? She nodded. He comes to clean, then he walks again. He got like 5-6 routes a day. You know how them homeless guys are. He goes all along the river till he gets to Frogtown, then he comes back. She pushed the bottles around. I don't get much tips over here, so people don't buy this till they're ready to go to a private party. I didn't know what to say. Her eyes were brown and muddy, as if they'd been washed in tea. I said, you know, a crew was filming your building today. She shrugged. They're always doing something now that downtown is cool again. Grady can't even get his food in the alley now. He comes back for dinner? She looked around and nodded. I used to take him a plate out there early before we got started. There used to be a Mexican food place next door. Take him 2 enchiladas and rice. Where is he going to be now? In the other alley next door, she said softly, at 6 o'clock. Every night, I'd take him a plate. I waited for Grady there. I ignored the other homeless men, the drunks from down the street who stumbled past the Golden Gopher. And then I saw him turn in the corner. He stopped about 10 feet from me and said, "Fantine?" I nodded. He said, "I've been waiting for you all this time." His hands were rimed with black, like my father's when he'd been picking oranges all night. Grady's eyes were tiny somehow, like sunflower seeds, in the deep wrinkles around them. All that sun, all those miles, all those years. "You told me you was going to live in L.A. after you left for college, Fantine. I married Glorette. I married her." His four top teeth were gone, like an open gate to his mouth. He said, "Didn't nobody else know. We went to the courthouse, me and Glorette." I said, "Grady, I came to tell you..." "Me and Glorette went to the courthouse after Sear Dakar was gone. He played the flute. I couldn't figure out why she loved him. He wasn't African. I seen his ID one time, named Marquise Parker. He was from Chicago. Called himself Chi-Town. Told me he was going to go to L.A. and play in a band. And Glorette was having a baby." "He's 17 now," I said. "Her son." But Grady stepped closer. The ripe, sweet smell of urine and liquor and onions rising from his coat. "No, my son. I was going to raise him. The car was going to leave every time. So I got him in my truck." "You didn't have a truck," I said. Grady had an old Pinto back then. He said, "I waited till the car came out that one bar where he played. I told him I had some clothes to sell. Then I busted him in the head and put him in my trash truck. It was almost morning. I took the truck up the hill." "Grady," Hattie said from behind me, "shut up." She brought out a foil wrapped package. "Eat your dinner and shut up. You ain't done nothing like that." "I did." "You a lie. You never said nothing to me." I wanted to tell Fantine. He held up his hand as if to stop me, but he was showing me his finger. Chicago had a knife. When I got to the dump, opened up the back of the truck, he raised up and took a piece of me with him. I had me a tire iron. Grady tucked the package against him like a football. "She loved me anyway. She still loved him. I don't love her now. I'm done."
Thank you so much. That was Susan Strait reading from The Golden Gopher. Gary, will you read from your story, Roger Crumbler Considered a Shape?
Yes, and, you know, your admonishment to us had to be G-rated, and, you know, normally my stuff has, oddly enough, has a fair amount of swearing and sex and violence, but this actually, because I actually wrote this story with Graham Greene in mind, is more of a genteel story.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, I was pleased that, you know, I have... much less of the quotient that I usually normally have. So this is just from a quick bit from the opening.
Okay.
Roger Crumbler considered his shave. On this, his 50th birthday, he was pleased that while his stubble became grayer each week, he still had a head of hair and it was still dark. The face in his bathroom mirror had held up pretty decently for half a century, though not for the first time he considered minor cosmetic surgery to correct the bags under his eyes, a trait among the men in his family. Was it true that Preparation H reduced the puffiness? It was a kind of logic to that, since hemorrhoids were what? An enlarged vein, right? But what caused those sacs under the eyes? Fluid? You'd have to Google that. It was always good to have something new to learn. Working the shaving gel into his whiskers, Roger smiled mentally, outlining the day ahead. At the office, he had to complete a final review of the Carlson Foundation financials. There had been no major blips on the radar, save for some inconsistencies on a pass-through grant from a city agency. The Carlson Foundation funded reading programs for low-income youth, and the city of Los Angeles was a partner in this endeavor. Such inconsistencies were not unusual given the accounting procedures of the bureaucrats versus the private sector. This was a minor concern, and he would resolve it with a phone call or two to his city hall contacts. Yet it was because of these inconsistencies that he was able to do what he'd done for him, for Nanette. Roger turned his head this way and the other, making sure he'd covered his face evenly as massaged the warm foam into his pores. At one of those precious West Side fundraising dinner parties, having saving spotted owls, or maybe it was spotted actors, a dermatologist with skin flawless as plastic told him that you should allow 5 minutes for your right beard to soak properly. Your night beard to soak properly. He didn't adhere to this advice each morning, but he wasn't going to be 50 every morning either. This was, after all, a big day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Gary Phillips reading from Roger Crumbler'd, Crumbler considered his shave in in Los Angeles NAR, and Roger does crumble. Poor Roger. Naomi, will you read from your story, number 19?
So this is a story of obsession. The person obsessed is Anne, a waitress. The subject of the obsession is a masseuse, and who only goes by number 19. I like to see number 19. Anne stood in front of the check-in desk of the spa on Friday. It was the same manager, only this time she was wearing tangerine lipstick instead of magenta. $100. Anne wasn't about to admit that she didn't have the money. I just need to speak with her. Number 19 working. A couple of other women in yoga pants entered the waiting room, and the manager turned her attention to them. Anne kept her place at the front of the line, but the manager just moved over to the side to collect the women's money and give them their towels and robes. You bother our customers, the manager said after they left for the locker room. I need to talk with number 19. Number 19 doesn't want to see you. You didn't even speak to her. You don't know. The manager adjusted her glasses and pointed to a sign above a glass shelf that held beauty products. We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone, it read. Anne was very familiar with the sign. They had the same one at the restaurant. Listen, Anne said, raising her voice. I can close this place down, you know. Yeah. The manager turned her back to Anne and rearranged some bottles of body scrub on the glass shelf. I'll tell immigration that you're using illegals. The manager snapped her head back toward Anne. What has number 19 told you? Anne's stomach felt queasy. Maybe she had gone too far. The last thing she wanted to do was get number 19 in trouble with her boss. Nothing, she said. Just that you better watch out. Anne walked out of the waiting room and went to the driving range to release some tension. This time she chose a spot on the far left side so she could keep an eye on the massage room door. One of her balls was sailing to the 150-foot mark when she noticed someone leaving the massage room. Number 19, by herself. Number 19, she called out and quickly walked over to face her. The masseuse lowered her head as if preparing to experience something distasteful. One of her bobby pins was coming loose, and Anne fought the urge to push it back in her hair. What's wrong? Did your manager do something to you? I tried to set her straight. That tip money is yours. Why you say anything? Not your business. Number 19 continued walking, and Anne pulled at her elbow. Number 19 wrestled back her arm, and Anne was surprised to experience her wrath. I fire! Anne couldn't believe this news. I was just trying to help you. You have to understand. No job, no money. How can I live? You understand? Number 19 ran down the stairs, and Anne, still carrying her nine iron, chased after her. But the masseuse knew the ins and outs of the building better than Anne, who lost track of her, then dashed outside and asked the security guard if he had seen the masseuse walking by. The security guard shook his head, so Anne headed to the bus stop to find number 19. But there was no sign of her.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That was Naomi Hirahara reading from number 19, also in Los Angeles Noir. I'm curious now, is there something that you can do with noir that you cannot do in other genres?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I suppose the idea being that if we, you know, if you adhere to the kind of construct of noir that the characters are heading toward a kind of doom or a doom of their own making, generally speaking. But, you know, it's certainly the case that there are examples of this in all kinds of literature to greater or lesser degrees. And I don't know that it's so much that I guess to me, also the reason why I'm a genre writer is partly just because I I'm sort of driven by the notions of plot, or the need to have a plot, the need to have a kind of structure, and maybe that's the artifice of the genre, because you know certainly in our lives that sometimes it doesn't seem to be much of a plot at all. But then maybe that's why we desire, as human beings, we desire a story, because the story does have a beginning, middle, and end, and it provides a kind of way to interpret or understand the world. So I don't know I don't know there's so much of that I think you can do. Personally, I just think it actually gets back to the point that Naomi raised earlier, which I think, to me, the so-called definitions of various genres or types of writing, to me, they bleed into each other. I think ultimately it's about, is it a story that you find compelling on some level or not, and does it entertain, does it resonate, does it do the things that a story should do for you? And I think if it does, then it's fine. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't really matter what it is, as long as you dig it and can kind of grasp the characters or identify or at least empathize with the characters. I think that's fine. I think it's done its job.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Susan?
I think that it goes back to the inevitability that we talked about in the beginning of the show, and I liked it talking to Denise about the way the idea of noir. Like Gary said, it means you have to have a plot in a sense. It's not necessarily that you have to solve something either, but maybe just that you have to understand something. But there's usually some kind of violence. And I remember talking to an editor of a really well-respected literary magazine about 7 years ago, and I was working on a story again that featured the same character, Gorette. And this woman said to me, she gets so many stories, hundreds and thousands of stories every year where there's no plot. There's two people talking in a car about their divorce, or there's two people in a motel room talking about their divorce, or there's two people, you know, in a restaurant talking about their impending divorce. And she just said that so much of contemporary literary fiction seemed airless to her. And so I was thinking about that just now when Naomi was reading her excerpt, too, because this whole notion of a quest is also a lot of noir, right? There's, it might not even be a quest to kill somebody or to learn something, but there's like an obsession factor, and that moves the plot forward. And so I mean, it's one of my favorite genres to read, for sure, but I really enjoyed writing it because of that sort of idea that people have to find things out and things have to occur. I like plot. Plot is a good thing. I don't know why literary writers are, oh, plot, you know. And that, I think that Gary's right. Readers want something to happen. I also like the fact that we talked about landscape because noir writers do the best job of almost anyone, I think, mm-hmm. with landscape. They really do. They move from place to place with a facility that I think a lot of literary writers don't let themselves have because they're worried about the language.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to get in trouble, but I'm just saying. I'm always in trouble.
Here's her phone number. It's
yeah.
Naomi.
I think for me in writing these kind of darker short stories, I feel kind of freer because I think I'm a genre writer as well. I'm not embarrassed to categorize myself like that. But I think with the other mysteries that I write, you know, there needs to be some problem solving. You know, you kind of need to rein the story back. You know, you can't just let it go free. But I think with noir, I've been able to kind of let, you know, my characters just go for it and run. And, you know, all these, I don't have to worry about these little plot points that need to be, you know, resolved at the end, you know, in full circle. So for me, it's not a necessarily a circular type of kind of plot writing development. It's I don't know, it's just like throwing it out there, you know, kind of like a fly fisherman. I mean, you are still struggling with the plot and the story, but ultimately you just let the fish go, you know. So, that's my metaphor for the day.
I like that. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I'm hesitant to throw out more questions. Maybe we should close with each of you you know, just maybe talking for a minute or so about anything we didn't cover that you think is important to the genre, to the noir genre, whether it be sort of the nature of the characters or the structure of the story or or noir stories that you love, whatever you'd like.
Well,
I really loved two or three of the other short stories in there that are based on people's stupidity. I don't know what Gary or Naomi think, but I loved the Anna Wagman story because that guy's just so stupid. I mean, Roger's not stupid. Roger's just in love. And Grady wasn't stupid. He's just in love. And Naomi's character is just obsessed. But I think there's some really funny, stupid stuff. And I like the way that that kind of sort of obliviousness leads to murder in Diana Wagman's story. And then who else would you guys say? I think also Janet Fitch's story has some really strange obliviousness in it, which I love.
Yes.
That's a weird thing to say, but I really like that part of noir where you always have to have characters like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do dumb stuff. It's fun to watch.
I think Jim Pascoe's story, too, has that kind of, it's a totally twisted kind of tale.
Yeah.
You know, where it starts out one way, the kidnapper belt starts out one way, and of course, obviously things go awry. But, you know, I guess real quick, Barbara, sort of to your point, I think noir never dies, and the reason it never dies is because we are capable of such heights of stupidity. Take somebody like ex-governor Elliot Spitzer, you know, who makes his makes his bones as a prosecutor in New York, and all, you know, bringing down corruption, and but also trailing guys who, you know, have mistresses or go to prostitutes, and of course he commits the same sin. Now he commits the same sin because of ego and hubris. I mean, because he believes, and he's got to believe that he's smarter. See, he's smarter than the other people around him. In fact, this is actually some comments from when he was busted. Some of the comments from some of the people that knew him, and so of course he thinks somehow or another that he can get away with it when nobody else can. Mm. And of course that's just human nature.
Right.
That's just great, because that's the basis of these stories, in the sense that we are all sort of, I mean, in the end, no matter how intellectual we might be and how learned we might be and how well read we might be, at some point or another we invariably give in to our baser instincts, these baser needs, and invariably it trips us up. You just can't beat it.
Mm-hmm. Naomi, any last words?
I just love the contemporary take of noir, because we could kind of leave, for instance, like the image of women in film noir, you know, the femme fatale, or, you know, the loyal girl Friday, you know, we could kind of take those things and transform them and make it more relevant to our society today. So I'm hoping to read more.
Yeah, well, I love the genre, and I also love that you three were willing to take the time. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks for having us.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
That was Naomi Hirahara, Gary Phillips, and Susan Strait, all of whom have stories in Los Angeles noir and are well-published elsewhere. And if you go to the radio show blog, which is writersonwriting.blogspot.com, I have links to their websites or ways you can read more about them. And definitely check out this book, Los Angeles Noir. It's a wonderful collection. Let's see what else. If you want to know more, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com, and you can email me from there if you like, and I'll put you on the weekly e-list so that you know who's coming up on the next show. People ask me about the music played on this show. The first song is Sarah Vaughan, Close My Eyes. The middle song is Brian Barrett, Come Back Baby, which you can also connect to on the blog that I mentioned. And the last song that I'll be playing is Etta James. I play these songs all the time because I love them, and because they, for me, they let people know that if you hear the song, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm going to leave you with a quote by John Le Carré, who said, "The cat sat on the mat is not a story. The cat sat on the other cat's mat is a story." Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll talk to you next time.